This show is a production of Migration Media. To learn more about us and see a complete list of our shows, visit migrationmedia.net.
From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I hope that wherever you are, whether in your home country or abroad, that you're safe and healthy, and that your friends and family are doing okay. The COVID-19 coronavirus that's sweeping the globe is having unprecedented effects on our planet. It feels like overnight we went from a world with ever-lowering barriers to movement back to pre-World War II levels of migration. I experienced this firsthand as my wife's parents were on a pre-planned trip to Southeast Asia when the countries outside of China began to take the spread of the disease seriously. For the last 2 weeks that they were overseas, they were literally one step ahead of local lockdowns and border restrictions until they made it here to Bali for their planned visit. Ultimately, the clampdown caught up with them, and we ended up having to spend a couple of stressful nights changing their flight to take them back to the U.S. much sooner than they'd planned, and then rerouting them for an even earlier date as connecting airports kept shutting down. Their departure has been followed by an inexorable slowing down of life on Bali. Hundreds of thousands of vacationers have canceled their trips this month, and tens of thousands of long-term residents have fled to their home countries. My wife Elisa and I are staying put, though. We've got secure housing, plenty of food and water, and good neighbors. We don't feel the need to leave, but we're ready to bug out if we need to. We're incredibly fortunate to have the stability in our lives that we do, and I intend to use that stability to continue doing what I've been doing for the last 57 episodes, bringing you the voices of those whose lives are lived overseas. Because right now, as walls appear to be going up, their voices are as vital as ever. Stay home, stay safe, save lives. This week we're kicking off season 4 with part 1 of a special 2-part series focusing on a pair of international migrants who have written a study on how the initial outbreak of COVID-19 in China affected foreign nationals living there. The lead researcher, Chris Barnhart, was a high school teacher in Florida who'd been laid off during a round of budget cuts and was as surprised as anyone to find himself heading to China months later to be the first foreign professor at a university in Guangdong province. His experience there has been a revelation to him, and his empathy and desire to check in on his fellow foreigners during the initial stages of the outbreak led him to want to quantify the resilience that he saw in the people around him. When he couldn't find evidence of anyone else studying expats in China during this time, he took it on himself to gather the data, and what he found was, well, let's let him explain how things went. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Chris Barnhart. Chris Barnhart, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be here.
Where is home?
That's a great question. And when I first heard it, I thought about that Mamas and the Papas song called Home, from the 1960s, where they say, home is whenever I'm with you. And I've just come to the realization that, China is home for me now. I've been in China for about 2 years, and I went home to America to visit my family after being in China for 4 months. And I thought that was home. I thought I'm going back home to, Florida, where my family is. And I found this weird phenomenon that when I arrived, quote unquote, home, that I had created a gap. I had created a gap in my family and all of my circles. And over the last 4 months while I was in China, they all kind of split and went their different ways. It was just everything came unglued and everybody kind of went in their own direction. They all split and went into separate directions. And so there was no place for me anymore. Whatever place I had been vacated and either removed or my family had moved on. And so I found very suddenly this internal crisis of, wait, what's home now? What's home? Is home where I came from, or is home where I'm at? And I really struggled with that for, a good year and a half. And my students, they would ask me, are you going home for the holidays? Are you going home for the spring festival? And it wasn't until just this year, this spring festival here, where I've said, I am home. I live in the city of Qinyuan for almost 2 years now. This is home for me. So I would say that the short answer to your question, Mike, is home for me is where my emotional attachments, my corporal presence, my energy, my base of activities are. So at the moment, that's right here in China.
It's so funny that you mentioned that that gap, because I've never heard it quite said that way. I know on this show, I've talked about what I kind of think of as the stages of being overseas. And the first stage is kind of after the first year. It's kind of like a first, quote, obstacle that people who live overseas have to get over. Like the people who move overseas after the first year, you'll go home for your first visit. And when you're there, you'll notice that life has moved on and things have changed and people have gotten married or broken up or new boyfriends or girlfriends and kids have grown up, maybe babies have been born, and it all happened without you. And some people actually can't handle that, and they end up, you know, going back to their home country. The people who can kind of get over that hump, they're the ones who can kind of stay overseas and make a go of it.
Right. I had a conversation. I was stuck in Hong Kong for 4 days for a visa issue. I thought I was going to be in Hong Kong for 1 day. I packed enough clothes for one night, and then ended up getting stuck there for 4 days. So I ended up at this hostel, and I met this guy from Canada who's been in China for 9 years. And I said, hey, when do you know when it's time to go home? And he said, it's indescribable, but you'll know in your heart of hearts. When it's time to go out of China, you will know. And so he was here for 9 years, and just this year he left to go back to Canada. And he was there for about 3 months, and I checked on him the other day, and he said, it's not home anymore. It's not home. I'm thinking about coming back to China. So interesting insight there, I think.
Yeah. So where are you from originally? Where did you start?
So I started in Orlando, Florida. That's my point of origin.
Not Kissimmee, Orlando.
No, not Kissimmee, Orlando. Downtown Orlando proper.
And so when did you move overseas? What's your kind of expat journey?
Well, that is a great question, and I thank you for asking it. This was a complete and total accident. I was a licensed public high school teacher in the States, and I was teaching I haven't been a teacher my whole life. I only became a teacher in 2016. I was in the business world before that. And so anyway, I got a business teaching position at a high school, and I was there for 2 years and became a rookie teacher of the year. It was awesome, and then my school did not renew my contract. So I became quickly like the darling and then unemployed. So that summer, I went to the job fair in my local school district, and there were hundreds of out-of-work high school teachers applying for half a dozen openings. And I just knew my chances of getting another teaching job were slim to none. And I spent that whole summer unemployed on unemployment benefits, just looking for any job I could find. I applied to teach in prisons. I applied to teach anywhere, like nothing was working out, and I was thinking about becoming a bus driver for Walt Disney World. You know, they were going to pay for CDL testing and all of this. And here I am with, you know, an MBA and almost finished with my PhD, and I can't find a job. It's pretty depressing. Well, my resume got picked up off of one of those websites, and I got a call from this young lady named Helen from this company called Teaching Nomad. I thought it was fake, you know, like Teaching Nomad, really, that sounds legit. But it was in Colorado.
Maybe it was phishing. It didn't have like a request for money from help from a Nigerian prince in it?
No, not this time. It was an actual phone call. It was a telephone call. But she said, this is Helen from Teaching Nomad. And I said, yeah, I'm sure you are. She said, no, really, we're based in Colorado, but we've got offices in Beijing and Shanghai, and we picked up your resume, and we have a client that's looking for someone to teach at a college. how do you feel about China? And I was like, I haven't thought about China. I'm just trying to teach here in Florida, you know? And she's like, well, let me let you just think about it. I'll send you some details and we'll talk again in a day or two. So she sent me the details and I looked into it. I researched the school and the location, which they said they were in Guangzhou, which is not accurate. They are in Qingyuan, which is a tier 3 city, whereas Guangzhou is a tier 1 city.
We should probably kind of just explain for people who might maybe not familiar with China. Tier 1 is like your Beijing, your Shanghai. Guangzhou is at that level. It's that big. It's that international. It's that cosmopolitan. Tier 3 would be like maybe not even Columbus, Ohio. It would be like some other, even a smaller town in Ohio. But at the same time, those cities can be huge in China. So like how many people are in Qingyuan?
So in Qingyuan, there are 3.5 million people. I lied. There are 9 million. I'm sorry, 9 million.
So there are 9 million people in Qingyuan, and that's the equivalent of a tier 3 city. So something below even a Columbus, Ohio in America. That's just crazy when you think of the scale of China.
It's true, and that's great that you explain that, Mike, because, yeah, people don't understand scale. Like that it's still an 8-hour, for me, it is an 8-hour high-speed train ride to get to Beijing. 8 hours on a high-speed bullet train. I mean, that is this kind of scale that just is difficult for people to grasp sometimes.
And so when you got there, you know, obviously it's not Guangzhou, but you got to this big city. You know, what was it like? I mean, was it like, I mean, obviously there's culture shock, but, you know, it's a big city.
Well, this is a funny story. I kind of compare it to landing an astronaut on a spinning asteroid in outer space and like sticking the landing, right? Like you're just praying that somehow you land right side up, because I had never traveled to China before. I had traveled to the UK when I was younger. So I wasn't completely new to international travel, but I ended up flying into Shenzhen, and I was supposed to get a connecting flight to Guangzhou, and I arrived at like 11 o'clock at night, and my flight was 45 minutes late. So the pilot of my connecting flight decided that he was going to go ahead and leave, and there were 5 of us passengers who were stranded in Shenzhen in the middle of the night and trying to find out how to get to our destination. So they gave us our bags, and then someone from the airport took us to the bus desk, and we had to pay like 200 RMB to get a ticket on a bus to, in the middle of the night, to go from the airport to Guangzhou, this place called the China Hotel. So really quickly, the guy said in the best English he could is that call whoever you need to call and tell them to pick you up at the China Hotel in Guangzhou. So my US cell phone, I had enough time to connect to the Wi-Fi and send them one message before my phone no longer worked. It was a miracle. So I sent the people from my school. I said, I'm stranded in Shenzhen. I'm taking the bus to Guangzhou. I didn't know how to pronounce it at the time. So I called it Guangzhou. And I said, pick me up at the China Hotel. And I didn't know, but there are several China hotels in Guangzhou. So they weren't sure which one I was talking about. So there was this in the middle of the night, my first time in China, and there's this bus ride out from Shenzhen. And I'm looking at a sky full of lights and high towers. And it really seemed like a magical place for me. And, because the cities really are beautiful at night, Mike. You know, there was an international trade convention in town, and so everything was very busy, even in dark. So my first view of China was at night, and I think that's special, because if you see the cities during the day, they're not always as romantic as they are at night. And so I took the bus ride, and I'm thinking, you know, here I am crossing the River Styx, right? like, you know, the poetic journey to Guangzhou. And I arrived at the China Hotel, and I got off the bus. And as I stepped off the bus, this guy from the school where I was hired had my WeChat photo, and he was showing it to everybody who was getting off the bus. And I saw my picture, and that's how I knew, okay, captured, you know, bam, it just landed on this spinning asteroid. I'm here. And so I was a little disoriented from jet lag in the middle of the night and getting through customs. And then we took an hour and a half car ride out of Guangzhou into Qinyuan, which is the city where I live and work now.
That's quite a journey. It's funny, you're kind of showing up tired and jet lag. I remember when I moved to China, I'd visited a few times by the time I moved there. But when I moved there, I can never sleep before I'm going to fly somewhere. It's really bad. I'm getting a little bit better. I can get a few hours sleep, but it's just awful for some reason. I'm not anxious or anything. I just can't sleep before I travel. I always have to pack the night before and everything. So when I moved to China, I don't think I'd slept in 40 hours because it's obviously a long trip. I can't sleep on planes. So I landed at the airport in Beijing, which I'd been to before, and I didn't even know what terminal I was in. So my buddy who was coming, the only person I knew in China was coming to pick me up, and I couldn't even tell him what terminal I was at, and I didn't even know. And we got to my apartment that I had rented like through Craigslist. And, you know, he had verified that it existed, so he knew where it was. He took me to the apartment, but I had to buy bedding. So we went to a store, got bedding, showed up, and I couldn't, like, go to bed or anything because we still had to meet the landlord and sign the lease. So I get off this plane, haven't slept in 40 hours. He takes, like, 2 hours to pick me up because I can't figure out where I am. Then I go to the store to buy bedding. Then we go to simple toiletries and stuff. Then we go to the apartment, meet the landlord, sign the lease. This takes like another couple of hours. And I have to say, it is one of the longest times I've ever slept. I arrived in Beijing on August 8, 2008, the day the Olympics opened. I literally slept through the entire first day. I didn't wake up until, I think I got to bed at something like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. I got to bed at like 6 or 7 because I arrived at like 3 o'clock or something. And then I slept until at least 10 or 11 the next day. I think I woke up in the middle of the night, ate something, and then I went right back to sleep. It was unbelievable. So I didn't get to do the opening ceremony or anything. Didn't go to any parties, nothing. I just slept for a day and a half. It's crazy. It's quite a shock to the system you had on your end. So you know, we're talking because you've done this survey where you've talked to expats who've been trapped in the middle of this virus, and we're going to get to that. But I'm just kind of interested in this. As someone who was in the U.S., never thought about moving overseas, was kind of given this opportunity, when you've been now there for a couple of years, do you feel like, I mean, obviously you talked about how you feel at home in China, but do you feel like, you know, fulfilled as a professional, as a teacher? Like, do you feel like you're getting to do what you want to do in this new country? And if so, how does that make you feel about, you know, going back theoretically to where you came from or what life was like before?
That's a tremendous and profound question, Mike, and it's a good one. I'm very fortunate because the job that I have always wanted to be a teacher. So when I was in high school, some people were in, some people played football, some people played soccer. I was in the club called the Future Educators of America, and I knew that I wanted to be a teacher, and actually I wanted to be a high school science teacher. I was involved in JROTC and a lot of youth activities where you learn how to teach your peers things, you know, how to put your uniform on, how to march, you know, how to lead. And so I have been teaching in one way or another since I was like 14. So I worked out in the business world, and that was not for me. I just did it so that I could get through college. And, you know, I would finish one degree and you know, I remember finishing my bachelor's degree in 2010. And we were coming out of the recession, and it seemed everybody had a bachelor's degree. So I was like, well, I need to you know, get to the head of the pack to compete. So I went on and finished my master's. But do I feel fulfilled professionally? Absolutely. I never dreamed I could actually be this fulfilled. I am the only foreign teacher at my school. In the history of the college, I'm the only foreign teacher. There's no foreign affairs office. I am a full-time member of the faculty, just like anyone else. I'm not like an adjunct or off to the side. Like, I'm embedded in the English teaching and research office. There are four of us, and I'm the only foreigner. So I live a privileged life because of my status as the only American in this part of China, in Qingyuan. I am the only full-time American resident, and that comes, I learned that from the police office where I have to register.
I'm sure they had no idea how to handle you.
Yeah, they don't. They have to look up on the computer to see what they're supposed to do because they've never done it before. We're all good friends now, so my students are as young as 18 and as old as 24. And watching them come to me without being able to utter an English word to being able to finish their 2 years of study with me by giving an English speech. And so watching them go from frustrated because they can't express themselves to finally being able to speak decent English and express themselves, it is very moving. And it is a much more profound feeling than I ever had in any other job in the world. So I very much feel like I'm helping these young people learn how to express themselves. And if you've never been able to express, like in Chinese, I can't speak Chinese very well yet. I am trying to learn, but I can't express myself, and I get frustrated because I can't express myself. And I know they feel that sensation as well. So I feel incredibly fulfilled. If that answers the question.
It does. And it's just kind of interesting the way when you're talking about being the first and the only, it's got to be super awesome to be literally a trailblazer in your field. And I don't mean to belittle, I'm not going to belittle what teachers do anywhere, because my wife's a teacher, I have teachers in my family, so I understand and respect and admire what teachers do. But to be a teacher in the public school system in whatever town you're in America, and then to go over to a place where you are a trailblazer, the first or the only in all these different categories. And that's got to make what was happening back in your hometown just be like, man, that was just ordinary.
Yeah, that was business as usual, whereas everything here is a first.
Now, that's got to actually do something to, I don't know, your psyche somehow. Like, it's got to, I don't know what that does. Does it make what came before seem less than, or does it make it seem special and formative? Like, how do you think about what came before when you're constantly dealing with something new and interesting now?
Well, I look at it as a quilt, Mike. Some patches of a quilt are small and some patches of a quilt are big. And so my life experiences have been different sizes, you know, on that quilt of life. And this patch is going to be probably very big. So I don't look through the lens of looking back and trying to compare it to now, because there is no comparison to this. Last year, I wrote the course standards for all oral English courses at my college. So when I worked in the district back in the States, the state wrote the standards and gave them to the schools, and the schools taught to the standards, right? What are your standards, meaning your rules, what you have to teach, this, that, and the other. Well, I had the opportunity to actually write the standards by which every oral English class from now until whenever, it's going to go by the standards that I wrote. And that is just something I cannot barely imagine have ever happening back home. So I feel like, you know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing in the place that I'm supposed to be doing it.
This is actually a good segue because as groundbreaking or as trailblazing and as new and interesting as what you're doing in the teaching field, you did this. You did the study of expats who were living through the initial outbreak of this coronavirus when it was emerging in China. And, you know, people in the West who will be listening to this when this first comes out will be going through and experiencing kind of that initial phase, you know, in the big cities in America and in Europe and through developing countries, this is spreading and people are having to lock down. But you were kind of in there and you're like, wait, how is this affecting everyone? What are people doing? And the reason I use the word trailblazing is because I don't think anyone has done this. I mean, you had mentioned to me, when our correspondence that you couldn't, as far as you knew, no one else was doing any kind of work like this, studying expats who were living through the coronavirus, studying their stress levels, how are they dealing? And for anyone, you know, we'll get into some of the details, but for anyone who wants to read your summary of your results, we've got it on our blog at migrationmedia.net. But can you just talk about what motivated you to do this or to decide, oh, I got to figure out what's going on with people? What was that process like?
Sure. I am an empathetic person, so I feel the emotions of people very, very heavily, sometimes too heavily, when I sense the emotions of people around me. I think it's a trait we all have, just trying to feel the emotions of people around me. And around the end of January, I started to think, okay, I feel stress, I feel anxiety, I feel scared, I feel panicked. And I met a colleague through a WeChat group, and she's my co-author, Jennifer Knight. And turns out Jen and I started talking, and she was locked down in Hubei with her friend. She's an American as well. And she was locked in with her in-laws and her Chinese husband. So we were thinking she was going to have the opportunity to evacuate out. Well, the U.S. consulate contacted her 1 hour before the flight, the charter flight, left the airport and said, if you can get yourself to the airport, we will take you home to America, but we'll have to send you an invoice for the flight. And she said, okay, what about my husband? And they said, no, you can't bring your husband. This is for Americans only. And so she was like, okay, well, that's not going to happen. Thank you very much. So I started feeling that there was dysfunction going on in the American response to this. And I don't want to sound unpatriotic, but I'm just relying on facts here. So Jennifer started telling me her experience, and I was curious about, hey, how are you doing? Like I want to know how you're feeling right now. You're locked down. You can't go anywhere. What's going on? So she started sharing some thoughts with me, and she's so wonderful, Mike. She has a career as a life coach, and she's also a teacher. So she's very expressive, and that led me to think, okay, let me jump on the computer here and just see if anyone's looking at how expats are dealing with this. Because my government isn't talking to me. But the Chinese government is. Actually, I got very early in the situation. I remember getting an email or a WeChat blast from the China Public Affairs Bureau, and they published the telephone number and name of every foreign affairs officer for every city in Guangdong province. So for your listeners, a province is like a state. So like the state of Florida, Guangdong is a province. And there's a foreign affairs officer for my city. So here early, we were getting communications from China about, you know, foreigners need to do this. Foreigners, here's that. Here's this website in English. So I'm getting all this information from the Chinese government that I'm not getting from the consulate. We're hearing almost a deafening silence. And so I got on the internet and I started researching, you know, anxiety in expats, or the more formal term is foreign nationals. We're considered foreign nationals, foreigners, or expats. It's all the same term. So I think surely somebody is working on this. All the papers being published, you know, around the time I started looking at it, the official name COVID-19 had not even been released yet because they were still writing the paper. So I thought, surely some genius is sitting around going to do some research on this. And I could not find anything. I emailed the American Psychological Association, the APA, and I said, hey, is anybody researching anxiety or stress in foreign people stuck over there? I got no reply, not even an automatic response. So very quickly, my blood pressure went up, and I thought, no one is looking at this. No one is considering how foreigners are coping with this situation. I want to know. I just want to know, even if I'm not going to write it up.
And at this point, this was really obviously the World Health Organization, and there were people making noise that this was going to be everywhere. But in the kind of general milieu of the news and politics or whatever, people really viewed this as a China thing. This is something you had to watch out for, you had to be careful for, you had to try to put up blocks against or watch for it. But this was something that was happening in China. And to feel like no one is helping you because you're a foreigner, and your home government and your home professional groups, and no one is focusing on there's 1 million foreigners living in China. And to feel like you're part of that cohort, no one is looking at you, no one is caring about you, that's got to be really distressing.
That was my assumption, but I had no data to back that up. So I'm looking at my data on January 21st. There had only been 5 deaths reported in China, and that's when we started noodling around with this idea. So there were only 300 cases and 5 deaths on January 21st, and it occurred to me that something is going to go very, very wrong, and obviously it just skyrocketed through the end of January, and February was really the peak of it. So I wanted to use this time. I felt like I was being given an opportunity here. We're in the middle of the largest viral outbreak in the modern era. And I have the opportunity to ask a few questions. You know, I feel a little, you know, journalistic almost. At first, it was just my own hunger to just know what was happening with my fellow countrymen and fellow expats, not just Americans. But, you know, as those who look at the results will see, we had responses from people representing 95 different countries. That evolved from, okay, since nobody is studying this, I have a responsibility. I have a response, like ethically, I need to tell this story in an academic way. So that turned into Jen and I writing a paper about the survey.
So when you did this survey, obviously you've got to go through your design process and all this. But when you started approaching people, or when you put the word out there that you want people to respond, or you want to gather this data, you're going through WeChat, as I understand. And for those who don't know, WeChat is kind of like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all combined into one super app, and everyone, and also WhatsApp, and everyone just chats on there. So people gather virtually in these group chats. And if you're a foreigner in China, you very quickly find yourself drawn into these group chats with other foreigners. So you're going around to all these foreign, chat groups filled with foreigners, and you're putting this survey out there. You're getting responses, but are people like pinging you back, like with any kind of feedback about the project itself?
Well, first of all, I didn't know what the clinical measure of anxiety was on my own. I just wasn't born knowing that information. I had to go to the literature and do a literature review, and I found a measure of anxiety, which I mentioned in the paper. It came out from Norton and Roberts in 2010. These researchers created this measure. It had X amount of questions, and then like a Likert scale of responses. And so that became approved as a actual measure of clinical anxiety. So that, of course, is published, and it's available to be used. So what I did is I took that questionnaire, and I tailored it not to just general feelings of anxiety, but I wanted to drill down to specific questions about interacting about the virus and the outbreak. So the original assessment was for general anxiety, and I took that and just kind of narrowed it down a little bit to narrow the focus to about the virus. I wanted to get responses about the virus. So I added four questions of my own because I wanted to know about communication with your country, communication with your employer, and how this is affecting your family and work life. Because I thought those would be really cool to know. There's even after I wrote the questions, I still wanted to ask more questions, but I had already published the link for the survey. And Jennifer and I published it to every WeChat group we could find, and she pushed it out on Facebook to some foreign groups there, and we had only gathered like 150 responses by ourselves. And I don't consider that a substantial number. It's certainly not a scientific or statistical significant amount, you know, 100 and something people. To me, that just wasn't enough. I wanted more. And if we were going to publish a paper, it needed to be substantial. So I connected with the leaders on a couple WeChat groups that cater to specific foreign groups. There's a USA foreign group. There's a South Africa foreign group. Anyway, overall, there were 60 groups, and I partnered with the leaders of this company called JobTube. So I partnered up with them and asked them if they would help me to push the link out to all of their foreign groups. And they did. And that is when, after a few days, we had over 620 responses. And the key about it was anonymous. So we were not going to ask names or any kind of personal tracking data. Just give us your answers and be open and honest. And so we thought that was the best way to go. But the qualitative data we got, Mike, was just astounding. We gave people a chance to write how they feel, what their emotions are, what their coping mechanisms are. And we were just shocked at the answers that we were getting.
What kind of feelings are people talking about? How were they coping? I mean, well, let me just ask the brass tacks question. Is everyone okay?
Yeah. It turns out that just about everybody's doing okay. They have in general, everybody's doing just fine. There are some cases of severe anxiety, but not really enough to say, look, everybody's lost their mind. Our expat community turns out to be very resilient.
Yeah. Well, I know that when I was looking at the data that you sent over, your preliminary results, I know you're sent this out to be peer reviewed, but when we sent the summary of the results to go on the blog, I remember thinking, you know, it looks like we're doing okay. And for me, it kind of speaks to the kind of life we live as foreigners in a lot of ways, because we go to a place, and especially in a place like China, where we are kind of isolated by the very nature of what we're doing. You know, yes, we have expat communities, but the kind of quote unquote normal emotional support systems of family, lifelong friends, even, you know, a profession that is familiar to you and has connections throughout your community, those kind of things that give people stability and support, those just don't exist for you. And in most cases, when you are a foreigner living in another country, especially a place like China, that is so culturally different. So it kind of almost makes sense that when something crazy or stressful like the coronavirus outbreak happens, you're going to have anxiety and stress, but I feel like as someone who's been living that kind of life for a while, you would be maybe more prepared or better equipped to deal with it.
That's a good point, Mike, because I've noticed in situations where if I go to visit my friend in Guangzhou, that's a huge city, and you know, on the subway, I get anxiety because I'm in Orlando, where I'm from, we don't have subways. So I go down to the Guangzhou subway, and there's just so much madness, and my foreign friend is just cruising through. He's not worried that he missed his train or... You know, and I'm freaking out like, oh, my God, we just missed our train. He's like, it's going to be fine. Foreigners have developed this this sort of resilience to functioning in an abnormal environment. And I think that's what you're talking about. And so I'm trying to learn how to do that. But I think the data that we've collected kind of affirms that, you know, yeah, everybody's agitated, everybody's feeling some symptoms, but they are coping with it. And the number one coping mechanism by long and far was they like to talk online to friends and family. So they're drawing in that support network to help buoy them during this time. But you're right about that. They are some resilient folks.
So you did a study looking at a wider cohort of people, and the data is awesome. And again, I would just encourage everyone to go to migrationmedia.com and look at the blog post. I'll also have a link in the show notes. It's really insightful, and I look forward to the final kind of full, you know, study when it's peer reviewed and published. But away from all of the other people and the wider cohort, how are you doing? How have you coped?
You know, I'm doing great. I think one of the main ways I've been able to cope is been able to go back to work, but not traditionally. We teach our students online. So about 5 weeks now I've been teaching my students online, and it's been a huge learning curve for all of us. But for me, that daily routine of, okay, I've got class in 10 minutes. Where's my lesson plan? Is my PowerPoint up? So living that routine has been, it makes things feel normal when I know they're not really. But I feel optimistic that we're on the downhill of this thing. And I look forward to getting back into the classroom with my students.
Well, Chris Barnhart, I really want to just compliment you on the work you've done. I think it's important. Like you said, no one else is really looking at it. I have a bugaboo about the wider world not talking to expats. We're like the first line of people who are experiencing things that are happening in other countries, and we're the ones who kind of can interpolate it best for people back in our home countries, I think, but we're not used as a resource. But I really love what you've done. I think it's super important. Thank you so much for sharing it with us on our website. And thank you so much for coming on and talking about it. It's been really valuable.
Hey, it's my pleasure. And I really appreciate the advocacy that you're doing for foreigners and expats. It's really great.
All right. Thank you. And stay safe.
Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Well, there you have it. Please check out the show notes for links to more information about my guest and to reach out with questions, feedback, and interview suggestions. Don't forget to subscribe and to leave us a like on your favorite podcatcher. Migratory Patterns is a production of Migration Media and is executive produced by me. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
This has been a Migration Media production. To learn more about the lives of international migrants and see our lineup of shows, visit us at migrationmedia.net or look for us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.